Welcome to another episode of Mind the Meds, the neurology pharmacy focused podcast from Pharmacy Times. My name is Erica Marini. This episode will be coming out the beginning of July 2026. I hope that everyone has a nice July 4th or had a nice July 4th. And for those who get it, a nice long weekend. We are firmly into the summer here. Now, before we get started, you know, if you are a loyal listener, which I say that a little sarcastically because this is still so new, but if you listened to the first couple episodes, you probably thought I was a bit overdramatic because as I only realized later on, I mentioned being nervous about staying in a hotel room with my two little kids in both of the first two episodes. So I feel like I need to address that and bring full circle and say that it's officially happening. When this podcast goes live, I will be spending the long weekend sleeping in a hotel room with my family for the first time since my youngest became a toddler. And I'm excited. I am excited. I think the sleep will be bad, but overall, the trip will be fun. It's somewhere local. It's kind of more of a staycation. It's about an hour away from our house. But yeah, I think it's going to be fun. You'll have to take my word for it because I'm going to give you guys a break and stop myself from talking about it anymore. Before we get into today's guest discussion, some updates that I found throughout the month. In FDA approval news, in the Huntington's disease space, gene therapy AMT-130 may be here sooner than we thought. There was a lot of kind of whiplash. I think one article described it as a roller coaster, which is totally accurate, where the manufacturer uniQure initially said the FDA told them that the initial phase 1-2 trial was going to be sufficient for accelerated approval. Then I think back in March, the FDA said, no, that's insufficient. You need a larger randomized double-blind trial involving a sham brain surgery. And now, as of just a week or so ago, we're back to the phase 1-2 trial being sufficient for accelerated approval. And while they still do obviously have to do a confirmatory study, the requirement for a sham brain surgery has also been removed. So that removed some of those ethical, I think, considerations. So uniQure now hopes to submit in the third quarter of this year for their accelerated approval. A similar turnaround happened for the accelerated approval hopes for a gene therapy for Hunter syndrome, which is a rare progressive genetic disorder caused by deficiency of the enzyme iduronate 2 sulfatase. And it does present with symptoms including cognitive impairment sometime between the ages of 2 and 4. So a similar kind of roller coaster for that drug as well. There's also now an expanded indication for olezarsen to reduce triglyceride levels and the risk of acute pancreatitis in adults with severe hypertriglyceridemia, so triglycerides greater than 500. Olezarsen is an ASO that inhibits apolipoprotein C3 and can reduce triglycerides by up to like 60%, so very impressive. I thought the expanded approval was worth mentioning in terms of overall lipid management, but right now this drug does not have data to support a role for reducing risk of stroke or other cardiovascular risks. So just something to keep in mind if that data does ever come out. We also had some updates in dementia risk. A drug adjacent finding was that in a UK study on cardiovascular diseases and dementia, hypotension was determined to be a significant risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, offering another piece of info in kind of this never-ending battle, I think, to keep blood pressure at optimal levels and not too high, not too low. High-dose omega-3 supplements were shown to not affect dementia risk. But more data does suggest that getting the shingles vaccine does. So if preventing that miserable shingles pain is not enough for you to convince patients to get the vaccine, perhaps letting them know about this fun fact could help. So in this study of Medicare beneficiaries, receiving at least one dose of the vaccine had a 24% lower relative risk for dementia than the unvaccinated cohort. So we can't say exactly why, but you know, even that statistic would maybe be enough to put me over the edge. We also had the American Headache Society annual scientific meeting here early in June. There was a few things that I want to mention from that. So data presented on elismatrep, which is a TRPM8 or transient receptor potential molastatin 8 agent that is present in peripheral sensory afferents innervating the trigeminal vascular system. So obviously really important for migraine management. Activation of TRPM8 in trigeminal neurons drives a few pro-migraine processes, which would be the rationale for use in study in migraine, upregulation and release of CGRP, induction of COX-2 expression, among other things. This would be a novel mechanism, specifically being studied for acute treatment of migraine. The phase 2B studied showed improvement in two-hour pain freedom versus placebo. Phase 3 results are expected later this year in actually a new formulation, the soft gel capsule, which should have even faster absorption than the tablet that was previously studied. Another novel mechanism presented came from the anti-PACAP antibody, bocunebart. Gosh, sorry, I should have looked up how to pronounce that one, which also had positive phase 2B results presented. This would be a preventive therapy. So PACAP, pituitary adenylate cyclase activating polypeptide, is a vasoactive neuropeptide localized to sensory nerve fibers, again within the trigeminal vascular system. Rationale for using in migraine comes from data that shows that this peptide is elevated during migraine attacks, and giving an IV of this peptide reliably induces migraines. So importantly, and this is maybe the most important thing about this, is that this system is distinct from CGRP, which could mean a new preventive option for patients who are not responsive to CGRP, which is not it's not a low number of patients who don't achieve adequate response to CGRP agents. Also, I think really important from a clinical practice perspective, a couple of retrospective studies on CGRP MAPs that were presented at the scientific session, one showing a signal for increased fracture risk. So this analysis showed that ourenimab, galcanezumab, and fremanezumab together were correlated with a 19% increase in adjusted one-year fracture odds. Of course, this was just observational. I didn't have the full article to review since this was just presented. And notably, it is not in line with other studies looking at bone mineral density and fracture risk, which did not show a risk with these agents. The authors suggest higher risk in patients with a history of osteoporosis, prior fracture, and higher comorbidity burden. So something to think about and just encourage patients right now as we look to get more data on this to have those patients make sure they're keeping up with physical activity and bone health recommendations. Physical activity, of course, can be hard with a high burden of migraine. One other retrospective analysis I wanted to highlight, because migraine affects a ton of women of childbearing potential, and this question comes up a lot. So the idea of pregnancy risks with CGRP agents. So this analysis showed use of CGRP MABs early in pregnancy was associated with a 45% greater risk of spontaneous abortion than in those patients not on CGRP MABs or on propranolol. So notably, another tidbit from this study is that propranolol alone did not have an increased risk at all. So that's kind of good for propranolol, but bad for these CGRP MABs, right? And while this is only one analysis, I think there have always been concerns about CGRP and its role in pregnancy and what blocking CGRP might affect during pregnancy and during fetal development. So I think this lends to the importance of family planning and preconception discussions with women of childbearing age, because based on this data, it's not enough to just stop the CGRP MAB when a woman finds out she is pregnant, because it's not going to be out of her system during that high-risk period, which this study deemed to be 8 to 12 weeks. And I think that might be all the time I have for updates. This podcast is definitely making me realize just how much news there is out there to consume. So I hope it helps you guys to have these short bursts. And if they're of interest, if anything I said was of interest, please go read more into any of these stories. And I know that fellow MS enthusiasts, we had CMSC, but we're actually going to review CMSC and recent MS data in our next episode with our lovely guests that I have lined up. So I purposely left those updates out of this month. But now I want to move on and get into our interview for the day. So keep tuning in. All right. Welcome to our special topic for our Mind the Meds episode today. I love today's topic because it is about neurology meds, but it really transcends neurology, and it is a topic that is forever relevant as well. So what I'm talking about, of course, is anti-seizure medication interactions. And here to talk about the recent paper, A Systematic Review of Clinically Significant Drug-Drug Interactions with Phenobarbital and Primidone, which was published a couple months ago in Pharmacotherapy, is one of the study's authors and fellow Northeastern Pharmacy alum, go Huskies, Dr. Adrian Wong and Dr. Kaylee Kirkless. Thank you guys for coming on the podcast. Why don't we start with introductions? Who wants to start?
So my name is Kaylee Kirkless. I am currently a pharmacist here at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. I primarily work in the med-surg and internal medicine space. Thanks so much for having us.
Great. And my name is Adrian. And again, fellow Husky, great to see you. I am one of the medical intensive care unit pharmacists at Beth Israel and occasionally staff in the emergency department as well. Which certainly sees a lot of phenobarbital, which we'll certainly touch on. But thank you for having us on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you guys again for being here. So yeah, guys, not neurology pharmacists, but like I said, this really transcends everywhere. I think it's going to be so applicable to any pharmacist who's listening. So now into our topic. So using medications off-label or outside of their normal scope, certainly common throughout all specialties. But the use of anti-seizure medications can, in particular, have a lot of complicating factors. What were you seeing in your practice that prompted the idea for this project?
So essentially, with the increasing use of phenobarb in our spaces, specifically with alcohol withdrawal, I feel like we've been seeing it a lot more recently. Though the caveat with that is, although providers might be like more comfortable with using it, there's less recognition or maybe even like knowledge of the significant drug-drug interactions that can affect these patient outcomes.
Yeah, definitely agree with Kaylee. I know that at our institution, we started phenobarb, I'd say about 8 years ago, so it's not as new here. But I feel that a lot of clinicians are always surprised when we as pharmacists bring up that there's a potential for drug interactions, as we were all taught in the pharmacy school. Phenobarbital and like rifampin and phenytoin are like the ones that are iconic kind of for being inducers. But whether or not it actually means anything is really important for us to be aware of. And I think as I progress in my career, becoming more interested in medical medication safety and the actual clinical relevance of drug interactions, that's been more important in how I look at these interactions. There's a review in the Journal of Pharmacotherapy that looked at rifamycins, and we were interested in looking at phenobarbital specifically because it can be used long-term as well as short-term for alcohol withdrawal. I think in clinical practice, certainly there's a lot of things that are important to touch on, but I think as medication experts, that's kind of our role. And whether or not that 1 to 2 doses of phenobarbital actually means something that is clinically significant for the drugs that come up in your drug interaction databases.
Yeah, I love your mention of clinical relevance because that's something that I try to educate patients and providers and clinic staff all the time on, you know, the red flag that comes up in the electronic health record and whether it actually means something. That's huge for us to be able to discern and be able to educate people on. Now, you guys did include primidone as well. For anyone who doesn't know, can you guys tell us why that would be important?
Yeah. So essentially, since it is a prodrug of phenobarbital, it would be essentially the same drug-drug interaction. And they wanted to just be more comprehensive in the evaluation of this interaction.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was really important and probably something that only a pharmacist would think of. So I'm really glad that you guys were involved in this.
Now, this systematic review turned out to be absolutely humongous. A total of 3,271 articles reviewed and 50 included. Now, what outcome measures were you looking for in the final article set that you reviewed?
Yeah, it was led by the work of a great API student. And we were really interested in three different aspects. And I think part of our clinical interest was really looking to see if there's any data specifically on how we would normally dose phenobarbital for alcohol. We all know that phenobarbital induces medications, and chronic use certainly is impactful, similar to rifamycins. But in our review, we really were interested in looking at things that, as you mentioned, a pharmacist would only think of. So like, how fast does this interaction occur? How fast does it take to resolve, which are always things that I think as an API student or a PGY1 resident, when I was in anticoagulation clinic with warfarin, because we didn't have DOAC back then, it was something that we really didn't have great guidance on. Yeah.
But before in the Stone Age, before DOACs, yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
And Kaylee will judge me on that anyways. But back in my day, it was great because you could see the change in INR when you had a drug interaction and learn from that. But I feel like with the increasing use of DOACs, it's a lot harder. I think we were also looking to see if there's a dose-response relationship, because the doses of phenobarbital are much higher than we would use for chronic therapy. And then most specifically, we were interested in any clinical outcome data that was impactful, such as laboratory PK or clinical outcomes. And we were definitely surprised by what we found. And we can get into that in a few questions, but we were really just interested in getting as much data as we could. And some of the dosing strategies for phenobarbital includes a taper. Some of the research that we've done at our institution suggests that it's actually not really beneficial. We looked at rescue phenobarbital adjunct as primary outcome, and we found that there's actually no difference in outcomes between a non-taper and taper group. So by including a taper, it probably just prolongs the likelihood that there's a clinically relevant drug-drug interaction with no additional clinical benefit.
Yeah, that's a really important finding as well. Would love to see that study as well. Okay, and you had mentioned this as well. So with what your outcome in the first, the onset and the offset of phenobarbital induction. So onset of induction ranged from 24 hours to 30 days in adult patients, and offset of the phenobarbital induction occurred within 2 to 8 weeks. So you had kind of touched on this a little bit. So when we're thinking about phenobarbital being used for things like status epilepticus or alcohol withdrawal on the inpatient side, but potentially you think about, the time, the doses that you're giving inpatient versus the times there's this interaction potential could cross over, inpatient to post-discharge, right? Is that kind of what you guys were getting at?
Yeah, I think that's like a really like strong point to bring up. So like, for example, like if we're talking about a medication like warfarin, for example, that we would need to and are able to monitor while inpatient, a lot of these patients might get, for example, like loaded with phenobarb in our emergency department or on the floor, and then a couple of days later, they're discharged. So while they're inpatient, we might be at more of a risk given that onset of it being an adducer for a thrombotic risk versus, a couple weeks out, it might be more clinically significant to be concerned for overshooting that warfarin dose as the phenobarb wears off. So I think it's important that we also have communication with like our outpatient teams that will follow up with the warfarin that, during this patient's stay that they, received phenobarb and how it can, affect your INRs in the upcoming days. Thankfully, something like warfarin, we have the, therapeutic drug monitoring in order to kind of assess whether or not it's still effective for them. But yeah, that's just what I would think about.
Yeah, Kaylee brings up some really great points. And I think some of the interesting things that we found were, although most of our studies were predominantly chronic therapy of phenobarbital. There were a good amount that were using it to like induce the metabolism of medications to manage toxic ingestions, which I thought was very interesting, which kind of leads us to believe that people also think that the onset of induction is pretty quick. And therefore, we should probably actually think about this as something that even one dose may be effective at reducing toxic ingestions, but that also might be someone's chronic therapy on a anti-seizure med or anticoagulant or something that they use for substance use disorder. And we don't really have great data to answer that question right now. I think the other thing that was interesting was the combination of both adult and pediatric literature. And we don't really can't really tease out whether or not those onset and offset really apply to or are generalizable to other populations, even within those age groups.
Yeah, there's still a lot to learn. I love what you brought up, Kaylee, though, about, you know, this kind of discharge planning, transitions of care, which I feel like has gotten, at least at my institution, a lot more pharmacy support lately. And this is certainly something that I would hope, and I'm going to pass along to my inpatient colleagues to make sure that, because often, you know, on a discharge medication list, it's not all the meds that you received throughout your stay. It's just the meds that you're staying on when you're discharged, right? And so it does need that extra level of education, you know, from a pharmacist or you know, another educated professional to be able to catch these things. So I love that you brought that up. A two-part question for you guys next. Which medications or categories of medications were most commonly reported to have drug interactions? You know, you mentioned anticoagulants already. And which do you think are the most clinically impactful, and were they the same?
Yeah, so as we mentioned already, our anticoagulants, so our warfarin and our DOACs, and then also immunosuppressants, so like our tacrolimus, and then antimicrobials like antifungals and antivirals, specifically like our HIV medications. However, I think like a little bit more clinically impactful, just from what we found in this study, is the DOACs, as we mentioned, warfarin, and then methadone, which I thought was interesting as well, just with the patients that had like withdrawal symptoms after receiving phenobarb when they are on methadone. I think that these are things that either we don't think about as much or we should think about more, just given the outcomes that were more clinically impactful in the patient populations looked at.
Yeah, you know, one statistic that brings to mind, a statistic from your article that was really striking for me, and brings home, like you said, just how important it is to not be complacent about these interactions. So in 85% of the studies, included phenobarbital drug-drug interactions, 85% of them associated with an impact on outcomes. So were you guys surprised by that number? Tell me more about that.
I'd say we definitely were. Obviously, we're looking for impactful outcomes. The funny thing is that one of the reviewers actually wanted us to remove that statistic because they thought it like kind of overstated the outcomes. But I think understanding that there's potential for publication bias, like you wouldn't publish a negative study, although we did certainly find people that published when there was no difference. I think one of the messages that we really want to get across is that there certainly are drug-drug interactions. Whether or not they're clinically relevant, I think, is the big thing. Certainly there are impactful outcomes such as fatal thrombosis that we unfortunately found. There's also the occurrences where someone was on warfarin, they were on a stable dose of it, but then their phenobarbital was stopped for whatever reason, and then the induction of warfarin went away, and then they had a supertherapeutic INR. So I think it's really important and kind of highlights what we as pharmacists can do. I think there's certainly a lot more research that needs to go into the area, especially for acute use. So it'll be interesting. I think the funny thing is that about 2 months ago is when this was our review was published, and a month ago or 2 weeks ago, I don't exactly remember, one of the APPs that we closely work with And then MICU sent me something on social media that talked about a pharmacist who was talking about some studies in phenobarbital and DOAC. And they said it was like relatively new data, but it's from 2024 and 2025. They basically say that it's confirmed that there's no drug interaction between DOAC and phenobarbital that's clinically relevant. But I think the findings within our review, as well as I think anecdotally, I think argues against that. And I actually just showed Kaylee that social media post. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's interesting because I think we look to like other pharmacists as a means of like, okay, like maybe they have the same thought that we would. And so I think this kind of just goes to show that there needs to maybe be more studies, research into this, but also that there just needs to be more education surrounding this information with like drug-drug interactions, especially like clinically significant ones. So like if you see somebody with like thousands of followers, kind of like tell that to people. I think a lot of people on social media would take that as essentially a source of truth, clearly if they're, you know, sending it to other health professionals. So as always, taking things with a grain of salt too, but when you actually look at the data, there might be, you know, something more there that says otherwise.
Yeah, definitely agree with Kaylee. And I think the other thing to add is that looking at those two studies in depth is really important. The first study actually maybe only had 70 patients on phenobarbital, while the remaining was like rifampin and phenytoin. And then the other one predominantly was the DOAC was dabigatran, which generally shouldn't interact with phenobarbital. So I think that really speaks to us as pharmacists, and Kaylee can certainly speak to this when we're rounding with the medical team and they're talking about an article. They might have read just the abstract or potentially just looked at open evidence and they come up this finding when you actually look at the article itself and actually doesn't say that.
Yeah, I mean, we are in an era of a lot of information and a lot of misinformation. And so absolutely being able to think critically is still so important. And I'm glad to have you guys on here to provide a little context for the findings that you had. Now, you mentioned thrombosis as kind of a very serious outcome. What were kind of, you know, less serious clinical outcomes that were affected, but, you know, still count, you know? Would that be instances of like immunosuppressant drug levels and those kind of clinical outcomes? Is that what you're also seeing?
Yeah. So essentially just seeing that, like, you know, not every patient's exactly going to be like looking the same. So if you look at, if you just like consider the medication that they're on. So whether it be like, for instance, like, tacrolimus or something along those lines, each patient's needs might be a little bit different. So thinking about its actual role in therapy, and then if there is any implications from either having like subtherapeutic or supertherapeutic concentrations, the underlying risk factors for outcomes associated with it should also be taken into consideration.
Yeah, I think further going down that line, certainly tacro levels, cyclosporin levels, as well as ART, dolutegravir, I think was the most one that we found. Whether or not decreases in those concentrations of medications leads to clinical outcomes such as transplant rejection or worsening of their viral load when they're controlled, I think it's really hard to say. And based on our study looking at the offset, we don't think that a lot of it is clinically relevant because it should be bounced back pretty quickly. But we don't actually know that answer yet. And I think once we are able to study this a bit more, it'll be helpful. But I think that is a great question in that what is a clinically relevant outcome and how do we monitor it? Certainly we can look at levels, but the thing that we ultimately care about is transplant rejection, control their HIV, And those are a lot harder to evaluate compared to something such as therapeutic drug monitoring. I think the other big thing that we're trying to get across specifically for alcohol withdrawal, there's been a lot of great data supporting its benefit over benzodiazepines, but it's still not the only medication. And certainly there are patients where potentially the risk outweighs the benefit for the use of phenobarbital. I think in vulnerable populations, and we'll touch on this in the next question, we might consider using benzodiazepines over phenobarbital.
Yeah, let's get into that. So in your study, you offered, you know, a kind of loose framework for evaluating patients prior to prescribing phenobarbital. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, so for each time that you kind of like see phenobarbital, at least what goes through like my mind when I see it, when I'm verifying it, is that it's, you know, looking at each patient kind of individually in terms of, you know, what risk factors they have, what is the outcome that I would be concerned with if they had subtherapeutic versus like super therapeutic levels. So for something like anticoagulation, which we've been talking a lot about, you know, if they have any other risk factors, if they, you know, recently had a procedure or there's other factors that would make you think that they'd be at a higher risk for thrombosis. Those would be things that I would think about whether or not I would be concerned. And if we're able to, like to Adrian's point, there's some things that we unfortunately do not have the capability of monitoring. So just, you know, thinking about the risk of potentially them being subtherapeutic if it is a medication that's going to be induced.
Yeah. And either of you, do you have an example where maybe you've brought up to the team, like, hey, maybe phenobarb is not a good option in this patient?
I think there was one years ago now where they were on Dilantin for seizures. And I think certainly we can monitor for therapeutic drug monitoring, but I think the difficulty is that you don't have much information right away on things like how well controlled their seizures are, what their level is. So there was a recommendation to not use phenobarbital in that patient, but as with most of the data for phenobarbital, a lot of it is for patients who've had severe alcohol withdrawal before, so they've had a seizure or delirium tremens. And the clinician thought the benefit outweighed the risk. I think speaking for that patient, later on, they developed a seizure and they had to come back to the intensive care unit. And their level for phenytoin was subtherapeutic, and it seemed to be after, I think, maybe 1 to 2 doses of phenobarbital. So I think it's really hard, I think, in certain settings, specifically in the emergency department, where you might not know all the information there is about a patient and you're trying to get more info. So you don't know that they might be a patient who was substance use disorder on methadone. Their dose is like 200 milligrams a day. And when we give phenobarbital, it's with the benefit in mind to manage their acute alcohol withdrawal symptoms. But when we look at them 2 days after and they might be withdrawing from methadone, I think it's hard to say that the benefit outweigh the risk. Certainly, there are other factors that might lead to withdrawal and other factors that may impact a patient's outcomes. But I think in patients who are at high risk, such as Kaylee mentioned, recent thrombosis, or they are substance use disorder on buprenorphine or methadone, I think it's important to consider how impactful that interaction is. And I think in patients with substance disorder on bup or methadone, they might be more apt to lose trust in the healthcare system, which we don't really want to happen because they already are affected by how the stigma is for those patients. And I think really it's important for us to think and even know that the patient is on these medications.
Yeah, that's important perspective. Yes, you said you mentioned you work in the ED sometimes as well. And I remember my rotation in the ED, and I think back to it now and, you know, you have to make decisions obviously very quickly and you sometimes don't have this data available. And you also, I think, mentioned a limitation to your current data set as well, which is, you know, how do you know what the interaction potential is with just a short-term use of these medications? You know, alcohol withdrawal you might use for a number of days and even do a taper if your protocol suggests that, if it's, you know, outdated, as you mentioned your data earlier. But in status, maybe we just used one dose of it. You know, so it's, you know, you have short-term use of these medications. Not all of the data, or, you know, hardly any of the data, it seemed like, addressed that situation. What are your thoughts on, or in your clinical practice, on how people should apply the current data to the situations that we're most often using phenobarb in right now?
Yeah, I think, Kaylee, you brought up a really good point a few questions ago in terms of we don't really know. And I think as pharmacists specifically, we should know that we don't know. And I think as most learners, they eventually get to that point. And I think specifically saying that there's no drug interaction is not very helpful when there are some data suggesting that even one dose of phenobarbital is impactful. What impact means to that drug or that patient is variable. I think sometimes we incorporate patient values and preferences, which I know is really important now. Sometimes you can't incorporate that when a patient is agitated and trying to punch you if they have alcohol withdrawal. But I think it's really an understanding of what data there is available, what we can do for monitoring, and also education of the patient or future healthcare teams like transitions of care. I think are really impactful. Personally, I think substance use disorder is a high-risk population. They might leave the ED after a dose of phenobarbital if they're now sober and their alcohol withdrawal is treated. But how that impacts the patient outside the hospital is not as well known. They might get care at another hospital. They might go back to harmful behaviors, which are not helpful for their underlying substance use disorder. Kaylee brought up the point about recent thrombosis or like VTE stroke. Those are probably patients we should not give phenobarbital to. And then also, potentially if patients are non-adherent to the ART and they already have a low barrier to resistance, then giving them a subtherapeutic dose of their ART is probably also not great for their HIV. Those are kind of the populations that I think are clinically relevant. I don't know what your thoughts are, Kaylee.
No, I think that I would have to agree with that overall.
Okay, wonderful. I think that there's some really great takeaways that you guys just mentioned just about those maybe specific populations where we should, you know, have our red flags going off in our heads if we do see this scenario coming through. You know, maybe patients, you know, a recent transplant, substance use disorders, recent thrombosis, all of these kind of, you know, already on high risk meds, and then you add another high risk med. It's potentially a time to be thinking things through very closely. Now, you guys mentioned you're actually going to be furthering this research. What are you guys working on now?
Yeah, so I think as we kind of like highlighted throughout this discussion, is that there might be, you know, a lack of understanding or knowledge about not only that there are interactions with phenobarb, but as well as like clinical significance of these interactions. And so what we're planning on looking at more is looking at patients that have received phenobarbital, looking at some of those higher risk medications that we would want to be concerned about. So like our DOAX, warfarin, methadone, buprenorphine, those sorts of medications. And then also being able to like survey different clinicians, both like pharmacists and other providers, I think in like different care areas, in order to kind of like determine how aware, almost like a pulse check awareness for what these drug-drug interactions are, and kind of to identify like potential knowledge gaps as well. So essentially, you know, talking and gathering data from those that most commonly use phenobarbital in order to know, you know, where do we kind of need more education for those people. I don't know, Adrian, if you have anything else to add for that.
No, I think Kaylee definitely touched on it very well. I think the other thing would be how it can inform our internal institutional guidelines for alcohol withdrawal, specifically for phenobarbital. We have it used pretty much everywhere, including the medical and surgical floors. So I think it'll be impactful for a lot of different populations within our hospital.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I think any more data that we can get, you know, for implications, so it's not, it almost doesn't go by the wayside thinking we're going to use this short term and it's not going to be impactful as far as drug-drug interactions, and being able to really have good data to tell people otherwise is going to be hugely impactful. So thank you guys for doing that. I think it's really cool that you guys are getting involved in research and you've been able to publish. So, you know, switching gears a bit, what kind of advice do you have for pharmacists who would like to get involved in research at this scale?
Yeah, I think, and this is just me speaking from someone who's like only a couple years out of residency, but I found that like if I have, you know, a clinical question that, you know, I might not be the only person that's asking that question. So I think it's great if you have like a, you know, natural like curiosity for the things that you're doing, especially in practice. I think that's one thing that I love about my job is that like I'm asking myself questions like every day about why we do things. And so the cool thing is like if you're at an institution that's able to support that, you can then actually like see that question out if possible. And so I definitely would say like, you know, just have that curiosity, see if there's other people that also have like, you know, the same question that you do. And then I think if you have like a support system at your site, I think that's also very, very helpful. So I think that those would probably be like the first steps that I would take in order to get involved in research. I know Adrian's experienced, so I don't know if he has more thoughts on that one.
Kaylee's just calling me old.
No.
So I was interested.
More experienced. In
yeah. So I was interested in research from when I was a student. And I think, as Kaylee mentioned, having interest, I think, is really important, and great mentors. I think getting feedback from others that don't even know you about your project is really helpful. And then asking for help, I think, is really important, either where you have a question about study design, how to analyze the data, just how to use a statistical program. But I think there's a lot of great resources that exist, and that might be internal to your institution or external. And I think another like unmentioned thing or underutilized thing is reviewing manuscripts. Not just speaking of my role on an editorial board for a journal, but I think it's a good way of looking at how research is performed and you as a reader, how you could improve it. And I think that is one way to improve your skills, not only on how to perform research, but how to communicate it. Certainly a lot of opportunities for presentations, even at your institution. But I think abstracts are a relatively easy way to do that as well. But I think really just getting invested and interested and understanding that the research that you do can inform your bedside practice, but I think it's a way of helping patients at other institutions that you won't be able to take care of physically. Is kind of what my internal motivation is from when I was a student.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. You know, I think you guys both mentioned, you know, the idea of using available resources and support. You know, I think that a lot of pharmacists have great ideas and maybe the passion for research, but maybe don't feel like they have those resources to take on the project. Maybe they don't know about resources available. How are you able to make research manageable, maybe, you know, amidst other clinical duties? And how do you think that pharmacists can effectively ask for support from management or other people at their institution?
Yeah, I think at least speaking from someone, again, that like has only been out for a couple of years, but I think finding someone that has experience with research is always very helpful. So for instance, like Adrian would be somebody that I would definitely, and I have
shown. You'll say, I think I know someone.
Yeah. That can just kind of be like real with you and be like, okay, like this is like completely feasible, or you know what, did you think about this, you know, component of the research product, which is great. So, and as well as running it by other people that are probably in the same space as you that's having the same question, I think having like different perspectives on the same question is always nice as well. I also think it's really helpful to have like a clear goal with whatever your research question is. And that's more from like a management supportive point of view. I think it's super helpful if you have like, here's my goal, this is the outcome that I'm looking at, and this is how it can change or not change, I guess, practice at your institution. And I think that does kind of help with the streamlining some sort of support from management, whether it means that you know, need some extra time to work on it, or you need help with like pulling certain data points. That has been kind of what my strategy's been. But I'm curious to know, Adrian, what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I think you bring up really good points, Kaylee. I think starting with a smaller project can also be a way of kind of working through it. So something maybe like a small MUE, and then if research isn't like part of your responsibilities at your institution, maybe your manager, once they've seen that you successfully completed an MUE, can understand how impactful they can be at your institution. I think we are relatively lucky here at Beth Israel, where we have a research committee that has longitudinal sessions, although intended for residents, but any preceptor is also welcome to attend them. But as we look for every residency year, we look at feasibility, which I think is probably the biggest barrier. Making sure that the sample size is adequate and not too much as well. And making sure that the number of data points and the outcomes are relevant to our institution. I think setting deadlines is also really important in monitoring your progress. And over time, we've definitely incorporated more of research into our responsibilities. And that has allowed us more time for dedicated, at least time for potentially data collection or precepting residents for research. And I think just finding the professional organizations that speak to you, they probably all have some form of research resources. You just need to find them. Discussion boards are another way, asking people, your friends at other institutions. But I think it's really just seeing what's out there and seeing what's relevant to you, I think is really important. And setting yourself goals along the way so that you don't get discouraged. But I think at the end of this, as Kaylee mentioned, knowing your goal, whether it's a abstract presentation at a local, regional, or national meeting, publication, but I think it's really just seeking help when you think you need it. And even when you don't think you need it, you should just seek help out as well.
Always phone a friend. Well, I love that perspective, and I love having the perspective of someone who's maybe just out of residency, relatively speaking, and someone who's been out there and in the research world for a long time. So not for that long, Adrian.
It's been a really
respectable amount of time. So thank you both for sharing those two perspectives. They really add a lot, I think, to the discussion. So I like to end each episode with just a little work-life balance. So I want to ask each of you to share somewhere cool, either nearby or far away, that you have visited and what you enjoyed about it.
So I went to Portugal this past fall, and there's a lot of amazing places in Portugal that I could probably have an entire podcast episode dedicated to. One that I thought was very interesting was like, and I hope I don't butcher the name, but it's Óbidos, and it's like this old medieval town that's quite literally behind a medieval wall, like right near like the coast, and it was I think made in like the 12th century, and it's like it's just a very like picturesque little town behind like a wall, and it, there's just a bunch of little shops in there. I think they have like 14 or something like that bookstores, and I'm someone that likes to read too, so I just found it to be like a really cute little quaint area. Unfortunately, it was pouring rain when we went, and I still had a good time, but I would love to go back at some point and like explore more when I had the time. But it's just I feel like I just don't see places that old, which Boston's has some historic sites, but not quite to that degree. And so I definitely think that that's cool.
It really means something if that's what came to your mind and it was pouring rain the whole time. So that means a very cool place. What about you, Adrian?
I'll speak of somewhere really exotic called Boston. I don't know the last time you went back here, Erica, but with the World Cup, you probably heard of the Tartan Army and the amazing Scottish fans, and it really has truly been amazing.
Did you join?
Awesome. Seeing how they've embraced the city, everyone's embraced them. They've had like fun with their tradition of putting traffic cones on statues. And I was out for the last Scotland game on Friday, and it was just amazing to see so many people out and about. Obviously, it was beautiful weather, but it was really cool seeing people kind of like adopt the Scottish fans because they've been really great for our, I'd say, morale. and it's just been really cool to see them. And now they've moved on to Miami, but we hope to see them back at some point. And I'm definitely motivated to go to Scotland to visit at some point.
That's awesome. Yeah, I haven't been back to Boston in a while, but if ever you guys are in the Salt Lake City area, look, let me know, because I'll show you around. Okay, well, thank you guys again for being on this episode. I know our discussion is going to be really well received by the audience and have a lot of things to think about. So again, thank you for being here. And yeah, hope to talk to you guys soon.
Yeah, thank you again for having us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Tune in monthly for more episodes of Mind the Meds, and have a great day, week, month.